Hello, everybody. This is Salil Tripathi from the Institute for Human Rights and Business. I'm talking to Jennifer Zirk, who is a scholar and a researcher on trade and human rights and other aspects of human rights and its relationship with corporations. She has recently completed a report for Chatham House on human rights impact assessments of trade agreements. This podcast is in two parts. In the first part, we discussed who should carry out human rights impact assessments. Should it be states or companies? And when during the trade agreement, negotiations should be carried out, at what stage and at what time? In the second part now, we will be discussing whether any human rights impact assessment of a trade agreement has had any specific influence on policy changes, and who should be paying for them, and what expertise is required to conduct them.
Do we have examples of human rights impact assessments actually influencing policy changes?
We asked that question too, and we did actually struggle to find cases where we could confidently say that a specific finding in a human rights impact assessment had actually led to a policy change. And actually, some of the people, we did speak about, you know, that issue of policy impact with a number of people who had actually been involved in EU processes, and some of them expressed frustration, particularly about the timing of the exercise, arguing that by the time the stakeholder consultation takes place, it's really too late in the process to have any impact. So that kind of leads to a certain amount of disillusionment about the process. But then you can see that there's a huge challenge here, can't you, about the timing. If you conduct your assessment too early, then you don't have so much to consult on by way of substance. You know, a negotiating text may be some way down the road, and quite a bit can be still up for grabs. So you're kind of potentially assessing a whole range of scenarios. But on the other hand, if you leave it too late, past the point at which negotiations have been buttoned down, then it's difficult to get anything changed or to make any changes. So that for me really suggests the need for human rights impact assessment in this context to be much more of an ongoing process, you know, rather than a single event that takes place. Something that actually can track the negotiations, but that's quite difficult. Once again, you know, you run up against this problem of the fact that in the background there are going on potentially complex, possibly contentious, difficult negotiations. You know, getting that balance right between transparency and having an effective negotiating strategy is really, really challenging. And also, I mean, all of the, you know, discussions at the moment around Brexit demonstrate that very clearly as well.
But that brings another critical issue, which, is often doesn't get talked about or until it's too late, which is the whole issue of resourcing costs. These are huge exercises, and especially if you talk about a continuing process, it means regular monitoring and regular analysis. Now, we know from, you know, when companies do their own human rights impact assessment, people immediately talk of conflict of interest because they're paying a social auditor to do that. And civil society groups typically don't have the resources to do it. And the state may want, but it also poses this problem because they may, at least the investment receiving states or exporting states might want to overstate benefits and underplay the costs. So how do we, this is not one of those situations with one right answer, but how do we resource this activity?
Yeah, it's, well, I mean, taking the resourcing problem first, that's an intractable problem. There's no getting away from the fact that these are really, really expensive processes. I mean, the expertise to do these doesn't come cheap. And so that creates really difficult dilemmas for the states, especially less resourced states, who are being asked to do this. You know, spending a lot of money on consultants to do this kind of work is, you know, can be quite difficult to justify, you know, unless you can show that the benefits are very, very clear. I mean, national human rights institutions have expressed an interest, and some have attempted to do kind of limited activities, but they really don't have the budgets to do this. Mm. I mean, you need access to very specialised expertise, which is difficult to come by. The EU has been very successful in, you know, developing their approach to this over time, but they have particular legal and constitutional drivers towards doing this. The political will is there because the political and legal imperatives are there as well. The conflict of interest question is really interesting. How you make them effective and objective, and it is a valid concern, and there are swings and roundabouts, you know, when it comes to who should do the assessment. and how closely that party should be connected to the body that takes responsibility for, the decision-making that follows. The European Commission takes the view that these assessments should be carried out by independent assessors who can take ownership of the process. And that they say that's very important from the point of view of, excellence and robustness and credibility of that process. That has its advantages, but some people also argue that if you have independent assessors, what you gain in relation to objectivity and robustness, you might lose in terms of impact, because there is a distance between the assessor and the people who are actually taking decisions. And they would argue that there's a need for much more integration, better communication between those people who are carrying out the assessments and those people who are, making decisions based on them.
Right.
So there are different views about what works best and how you strike that very tricky balance between independence and credibility on the one hand, and on the other hand, policy coherence and impact, and making sure that those, those recommendations actually get taken up. In the report itself, we've listed up some various permutations of, different models and different degrees of independence that you can build into the process, and the advantages and disadvantages of that. I think there's no one answer.
And the other question is, again, about the big what if type of a question, which is that a lot of the focus is, understandably, on initiating trade or trade liberalizing and looking at the impacts of that. But should a robust and impact assessment methodology also look at the impact of not trading? So if you impose tariffs, or if you decide to have some kind of a quotas on not buying certain products because it has a problem, that also would have negative impacts, in terms of consumer access to products in your own country and in terms of jobs being not created in other countries where there is a lot more poverty. So is there a way to do that in human rights impact assessment, or is this like the version 2.0 or 3.0 that we are talking about?
You're quite right. The context in which we discuss these things, human rights impact assessment, is normally in the context of a liberalizing trade measures. What will the impact be if we take away this tariff or that subsidy or these non-tariff barriers? But going back to a point I made earlier, if the human rights impact assessment is to be done well, it also has to take account of scope for the use of restrictive measures under the agreement. And virtually all the trade agreements do provide that flexibility for states to be able to not trade or to put barriers up in certain circumstances.
Right.
So you have to take account of that if you're going to do human rights impact assessment well. And some human rights impact assessments have used different liberalising scenarios. So if they're doing something very early in the process and they're not sure what degree of liberalisation is going to come out of this, they can sort of model based on different scenarios in order to provide a kind of spread of outcomes and impacts, which you can then sort of take up depending on where the agreement ends up. But obviously that greatly increases the complexity of the task and the cost as well, I would think. But going back to the broader point, if a state wanted to pursue a very protectionist trade policy, I expect it would be possible to use similar kind of modelling techniques to identify likely effects on jobs and consumers and then enhance that by using human rights analysis to get down to the level of individuals and families.
Right.
And I expect you'd probably do this in much the same way as you might apply a human rights impact assessment to perhaps a development policy or new policy for reforms. Obviously, there's a debate to be had about whether that's the right approach from a human rights perspective.
Right.
And what the human rights obligations might be in that kind of scenario. But I think either way, it's important for states to be able to understand the human rights consequences of the policies that they pursue. So I think there's an argument for that. I'm not suggesting though that it would be a very easy task.
Yeah.
For all the reasons that the report identifies.
Well, there are macroeconomic models that do let you figure out the loss of economic welfare of imposing a tariff in terms of jobs lost or jobs not created, or revenue foregone, or taxes that might increase. Exchequer might gain something, but investment that won't happen. But a lot of it is estimations, and a lot of it is predictions based on other things. The classic phrase in economics is ceteris paribus, other things being equal. Other things are never equal. That's part of the problem here, yeah. But at least you can get a numerical figure of imposing a tariff, and then it becomes a political choice whether to do it or not. And my last question kind of, you know, dances around, I mean, we've danced around this issue earlier, and I think it's at the heart of some of what we are doing, who should be, in a way, about who should be doing the trade negotiation, and it's related to that, that who should be doing the human rights impact assessment? Should it be auditors, economists, anthropologists, industry experts, human rights experts? Obviously, it is a bunch of skills. So which are the skills you would like to see in an assessment team?
It does depend on the nature of the assessment, the scopes, the countries involved. But the fundamental point is that there's an enormous range of human rights impacts that could come from a significant intervention like this. So that really highlights the need for a multidisciplinary team. So obviously you need, as you were saying just now, you need significant expertise in economic modelling for a start. And our research really highlights the need for legal expertise as well. I mean, obviously you need human rights law expertise for obvious reasons, but you also need trade law expertise to be fed into that. And the reason for that is you need a good understanding of what's likely to be in the trade agreement, what that means in practice, and how that can be, you know, the variations in how that can be implemented. And that's really needed so that you make sure that the impacts that you identify that look like they come from a trade agreement are actually coming from the trade agreement and not, you know, some extraneous factors,
right,
or something to do with the way it's being implemented, you know, the political decisions involved in how the trade agreement's implemented. Depending on the nature and the scope of the assessment, you may need other specialist expertise, such as cultural anthropologists. You may need, you know, scientific expertise to interpret environmental data.
Right.
You might need experts from the field of public policy or international relations for a really good understanding of the economic or political setting that you're working in that could have a bearing on implementation. You'd need to be talking to people on the ground, to representatives of trade unions, and you know, people with local knowledge. I mean, and it's for this reason that these assessments follow a fairly sort of uniform path through, firstly, preparation to sort of identify the main issues, and then working through scoping, analysis, stakeholder consultation, recommendations. And those initial preparatory exercises would help to clarify exactly the kind of expertise that you need.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. Thank you for the report, and thank you for provoking all these questions.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.